This is a special Invest Talk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Remember, the Invest Talk phone lines never close. Please call with questions. 888-99-CHART. 888-99-CHART. They will be played and answered on an upcoming Invest Talk podcast.
So talk to Mark in San Diego. Let's talk about the energy sector.
Yeah, I got a bunch of the big Vanguard ETFs in energy and oil. And, of course, they peaked out a couple of weeks ago, and I'm wondering if it's time to sell some calls on them as they slowly start to retract over the summer.
Well, it depends on your view of where oil prices are going. Now, what's interesting is that after the earnings season, the most revised positively sector in the market was the energy sector, meaning the movement in Q2 earnings expectations moved up the most in the energy sector out of all 11 sectors in the market. So the earnings picture is actually improving, but obviously near term, the oil prices have come down. You know, do you sell calls? I'd rather sell calls when things are overbought, not oversold.
Right. That's my question. Yeah.
And right now it's oversold. So I wouldn't be quick to be selling calls in that environment.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thanks for the call, Mark.
Hey, Luke, how you doing? I am a cash flow investor. And listening to the show, you guys have talked about shorter duration bonds. They're paying around 5% or so right now. So my question is, why would I put the money in bonds as opposed to a money market, which is now paying over 5% as well? I know that the money market's variable, but you know, we do believe that it's going to be higher interest rates for longer. And if I'm doing shorter duration bonds anyway, isn't that a very similar thing? But my money is more liquid and less prone to, yes, I can cash out early and get the full principal back without having to wait to maturity to get the full principal back. Just wanted to get your thoughts on the differences and the advantages of both. Love the show. Thanks a lot.
Well, what you're talking about are very similar types of investments. Short-term fixed income, whether it's a money market or, say, a short-term government bond ETF, shall we say. Both are very liquid. Now, money market's a little bit more liquid, shall we say. But often you can get a little bit better yield with, say, a short-term money market. So short-term treasury bond ETF. For example, I'm looking at one. It's 5.25% right now in yield. Not sure if you can get that from a money market. Some pretty good ones maybe get close. But, you know, if you have an ETF, you do kind of have to wait for that settlement. Settlement is going T+1. At the end of this month. So that's a positive where you can sell it and get the cash the next day. Whereas money market, if you need it that day, you know, that's a little more liquid. But they're very, very similar. Both are going to fluctuate with interest rates. But like you said, if interest rates are headed higher, then, you know, it's going to be good to have that short duration. And that's what I encourage most bond investors. And so that's why let me rephrase that. That's what I encourage most bond investors to do, is to keep duration limited. So once again, you're splitting hairs here. Both work. It's just a matter of whether you want to pick up a little more yield from the short-term government bonds. And remember, not all bonds are created equal. You know, a short-term government is very different than a 30-year Treasury bond ETF like a TLT.
Every investor is working to build a secure financial future.
Would this be an opportune time to get into annuities?
Everyone's situation is different.
Get your thoughts on CRM, Salesforce.
And so are their questions.
And I was just calling for your assessment of Blackstone Incorporated.
24/7, rain or shine, InvestTalk is made better by the power of you. 888-99-CHART.
Hi, Luke and Justin. I hope you're both well. My name is Onur. I'm from Kansas City, and I'm interested in investing long-term. I have a question about stock valuation, particularly regarding the P ratio. Are there simple rules or formulas that you guys use both with the PE ratio along with one or two other metrics? For instance, I was wondering if consistent 10% earnings growth could justify a PE ratio of 10. I know this is oversimplistic, but I'm curious if you have any guidelines to initially assess a stock before diving into a more detailed analysis. I would appreciate any advice you could give. Thank you very much.
So the question is surrounding how to, if I'm getting this correctly, essentially do a first pass. So before diving in to an individual company, the technical aspects of it, the fundamental aspects of it, how can you sort through and have criteria based on valuation, which is a good first pass criteria, of what to look at? Some people use price to earnings. I like price to book value historically. Doing any sort of market valuation to fundamental valuation multiple essentially gives you mostly the same results. The reason why price to book works well is because it's primarily based on the market value of essentially the company's assets relative to the assets that it owns. So that is more of a pure, if you will, way to look at relative valuation, whereas price to earnings incorporates analyst estimates. It incorporates forward-looking guidance. It incorporates profitability. And so if you're trying to look at relative valuation, I prefer to look at price to book, enterprise value to EBITDA. Now, keeping that in mind, there is no one-size-fits-all rule. Why is that? Because different sectors are going to have different types of price to earnings ranges, because different sectors are growthier. You're going to find way higher price to earnings in tech sectors, in the tech sector, than you are in materials. And that's just the nature of the business. You should be willing to take on a higher price to earnings multiple if you have higher sustainable good growth. And I mean good growth because I don't mean one-off ancillary growth. I mean real growth that is consistent, real growth that is within the primary operating area of that business. And so if I were to give you one piece of advice, it is to think about like-kind companies, and your best friend is comparable analysis. Look at averages of the sector, look at averages of the sub-industry, look at averages of like companies, and that will tell you how the company you're looking at relates to the overall industry and sector as a whole. Thanks for the call.
You are listening to an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART. On radio, on YouTube, streaming live on investtalk.com.
My question today is about H&E Equipment Services, Inc.
And for our podcast subscribers.
If you're willing to take the risk,
InvestTalk.
If you're okay with that risk,
with host and financial advisor Justin Klein,
and that volatility, go for it.
And co-host and portfolio manager Luke Guerrero.
This company has fallen like a rock. It's down 52%.
InvestTalk.
Ticker symbol THT.
Everybody wants a secure financial future.
Richard, you have a question about TOL?
But getting there takes strategy, discipline, and the right information.
Wonder what you think of the price of it.
Go to Chris in Maine looking at IEX.
Hey, Justin. I own it. Just seeing what you thought of it.
InvestTalk is made better by listener contributions. So don't forget to call 888-99-CHART. This is an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART.
Hey, Stephen, Luke, had a question for you regarding index-linked variable annuities. My understanding is that you receive a index performance with a downside buffer with an uncapped potential for gains and some sort of participation rate on top of that performance. Wondering if there's a catch. Seems like it's too good to be true. Is there anything I'm missing? Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, you are missing the fees. And it's something that Steve always talked about. And that was that you are you're paying for the index. Yes, you're linked to an index, but there are still fees taken out. Okay. So don't think that it's one for one, dollar for dollar. The SP was up 18% that year and you're getting 18%. No, there are fees that you do have to pay. And that is something that most of the, you know, the broker is not going to tell you. Okay. And on top of that, you are giving up liquidity. There is a surrender period, usually between 5 and 10 years. And that's because they are, the insurance company is trying to make back the commission that it paid the salesperson. Okay. So annuities, I have never had anybody that I know, client, non-client, that I've talked to, that was happy that they bought an indexed annuity, a variable annuity, a universal life policy, a whole life policy. Years in, they're always either ambivalent, it's okay, or not happy with it. Nobody's ecstatic with it. Nobody. 0% of people that I've talked to have been ecstatic that they bought an indexed annuity, a variable annuity, once again, a whole life or universal life policy. So the results kind of speak for themselves. It's all marketing, and they don't tell you they don't discuss the fine print. And there's a lot of fine print because, as Steve always said, these are big contracts. And they tell you the big top line pros, but they don't discuss the bottom line cons. Annuities are for one thing and one thing only, and that is to buy a fixed annuity for a certain small subset of people that's trying to guarantee themselves an income stream in retirement. Maybe they're trying to supplement their Social Security so that they cover all their basic expenses. And then from there, it's kind of the rest of their money might grow and they want to have that security there, right? And everything else is more of a plus. So for some people at or near retirement, that can work, but very few people should ever buy an indexed annuity. Thanks for the call.
On radio, on YouTube, streaming live on investtalk.com.
My question today is about H&E Equipment Services, Inc.
And for our podcast subscribers.
If you're willing to take the risk.
InvestTalk.
If you're okay with that risk.
With host and financial advisor Justin Klein.
And that volatility. Go for it.
And co-host and portfolio manager Luke Guerrero.
This company has fallen like a rock. It's down 52%.
InvestTalk.
Ticker symbol THC.
Everybody wants a secure financial future.
Richard, you have a question about TOL?
But getting there takes strategy, discipline, and the right information.
Wonder what you think of the price of it.
Go to Chris in Maine looking at IEX.
Hey, Justin. I own it. Just seeing what you thought of it.
InvestTalk is made better by listener contributions. So don't forget to call 888-99-CHART.
Now let's keep it moving. Go back to the InvestTalk voice bank for a question that came in earlier. You know the number, 888-99-CHART.
Hey, Luke or Justin. Jake here from North Carolina. Just had a question about your investment philosophy overall and how you apply that to your clients' investment accounts. The firm that I work for uses the business cycle as our framework for when to buy, when to sell, what to buy, what to sell. But I was just curious as to the degree of which you use the business cycle to inform you of your investment decisions in your managed client accounts or otherwise. Thank you very much. Looking forward to hearing on the show.
Yeah, that's a great question about how to use the idea of the business cycle to inform your allocation decisions. And so I always try and stress that portfolio management generally is a holistic thing, right? It shouldn't just rely on any one factor. Because where we are in the business cycle is certainly something that's open to interpretation from different market participants. Recall, we should have had a recession a while ago. And so the way we like to think about it is not just where we believe we are in the business cycle and how that should change our sector allocations, but what's the market doing? And how do we look at how the market is interpreting where we are cyclically? Well, we know names that tend to perform well in different areas of the business cycle. We know names that tend to perform poorly. So looking at how the market in terms of its momentum prices things, right? A great proxy, Russell 3000, looking at the entire U.S. market. What percentage of those names are down momentum names? Which ones are lagging the market? Which ones are doing well? What does that tell us about where we are in the business cycle? How should that inform us on how we should allocate across sectors? Should we trim? Should we buy more? How have the movements of the securities within our clients' portfolios changed those sector weightings? So keeping all of that in mind, the business cycle is certainly one piece of it. And for us, it's more than just about what we think. It's about what the market thinks overall and how that can inform our investment decisions. Thanks for the call.
You are listening to an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART. You are listening to an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. Got a question about conversion of a Roth 401k to a Roth IRA after separation of employment. I've got about $700,000 in a Roth 401k that I had converted to Brokerage Link, still all Roth. I separated employment and had the option to move it to my Roth IRA. I couldn't move it like in kind. They would have to liquidate everything and then move it as cash, and then I would have to reinvest it. So my question is there an advantage to that? Is there added risk to that? Right now in the Brokerage Link, even though it's a Roth 401k legally, I can't take out the contributions without a penalty. But somehow if I convert it to my Roth IRA and I needed to do so in a pinch, then the Roth IRA rules apply. Look forward to hearing your thoughts. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, you just talked about the pros of moving that over to a Roth IRA. You know, if it's in a brokerage link, hopefully you can buy whatever you want. Most brokerage links you can. And therefore, there might not be a big upside to that. Now, I don't know what the brokerage link is through. Most 401ks, they have, you know, their standard suite of investment options, mutual funds. And then some of them are allowed to opt some of that money or all that money into a brokerage link. And that's typically at Fidelity or Schwab or E-Trade, one of the big brokers. Now, the good thing, the current situation is you're locked into whatever broker that is. And that might be one you like. It might be one you don't like. And rolling into a Roth IRA allows you to open that Roth IRA anywhere. Now, like you said, you have to liquidate it. And that's going to be a process. And that typically takes, you know, a week to 2 weeks to get that money moved. And, you know, who knows where the market is. Might be beneficial. You might do it at a time when the market's down and you can rebuy things at a lower price. You know, that's the risk is that it goes the other way, though, which is the market goes up and you miss out on some gains. Typically, I would say do it, but only if you have a broker that you think would be much better and you think you'd tap into that money at some point.
A quick reminder, if there's a term that you hear mentioned on the program, but you're unclear about what it means or you have a question about it, we want you to ask. It's very likely that you're not the only one with that same question. 888-99-CHART.
This is Ben from Orlando. I know this question has been asked and answered before, but I could use a refresher. I have a Roth 401k through my employer, and in the event of leaving my employer, can you explain the steps of how to roll over your 401k? And I believe there was a certain verbiage you said to use that would ensure that you are not penalized when doing so. I'll listen on the show. Thanks.
It's very simple. If you have a Roth 401k, you want to open a Roth IRA. We always recommend a large brokerage firm. And if you have a traditional 401k, you want to open up a traditional IRA. Now, some people have both. They might have a 401k with a little bit of both, a little bit of Roth money, a little bit of traditional, but you're going to roll like for like. Roth to Roth, traditional to traditional. And the mechanism is simple. Like I said, you have to set up those accounts. You have to have those type of accounts somewhere. And then you're going to call your 401k provider and you're going to say, hey, I want to do a rollover. Please issue me a check. Now, some providers will send that check directly to your broker. Some will say, no, we can only send it to your address. There's an extra step. They'll send it to your address. You'll just mail it off to your broker. So we always like it. It's always cleaner when you can just mail it directly to the broker, have it made out to you for or to that brokerage firm for benefit of your name, et cetera. Every brokerage firm is different, so they'll give you instructions on how to do that. But there is a liquidation process. They will sell all the funds within that 401k. So you'll have a week or two period where you won't be invested. So understand that. But it's a relatively a simple process. And pretty much everybody should be doing this. If they have an old 401k of any type, they should be rolling that into an IRA of the similar type. Thanks for the call.
Hi, Dave from Ohio. My question is about preferred stocks. If you could shine a little bit of light on them, I'm trying to produce like an income stream. If it's a good idea, or just your general thoughts. I'll be looking forward to your answer. Thank you.
Yeah, so preferred stocks are similar to bonds in that they typically pay fixed dividends. They have priority over common stocks within the capital structure of liquidation of a business. And they have, because of that, limited upward mobility in terms of price appreciation and also limited voting rights. So historically, people tend to invest in preferred stocks, not for their ability to be a voting equity investor, but rather for a more certain revenue stream. But given where we are in terms of the higher interest rate environment, we think interest rates actually, although they may be cut in the short term or in the long term, going to be higher. The trade-off for owning preferred stocks versus the risk of what you get for them being still a equity security doesn't seem to make sense in a non-zero interest rate environment. So, you know, in short of it, they tend to be a more complicated instrument than just owning a bond where you have a secure revenue stream as well and higher priority in terms of dissolution of the company. So but that's just a little high level. Obviously, there's more going into it, but either way, that's a quick summary of preferred stocks.
This is an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It is official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This is a special InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Remember, the InvestTalk phone lines never close. Please call with questions. 888-99-CHART.
Looks like we have another live call from Joe in Kentucky who wants to talk about electric vehicles, something we'll be talking about a little bit later on as well.
Hey, thanks a lot for taking my call. Yeah, man, I'm in my early 40s in Kentucky, and I got a buddy in Vegas who's always been bullish on Tesla. I mean, he was bullish on them in 2012. I bought, I've listened to you guys for years. Even when your colleagues were bearish on them, I bought, and they've done well. But I've just gotten lucky, honestly. I'm not big on single stocks because I usually invest in index funds. But I was just curious because, like, me and him is talking and about Tesla, and he's, like, raising his two-year price target for Tesla to, like, $500. And the reason is, in his opinion, their car business will be that will be their fourth most valuable asset behind FSD, which is full self-driving, robotics, and energy. And, you know, he does think that they'll produce the world's best microprocessor within 2 years. So, you know, he's very quite bullish on them. From your all's point of view, I was just kind of curious if you had a contrarian viewpoint on this. Because I personally think that I think it's a good thing to put your money in Tesla, but I was just curious what you think on your professional expertise on the company as far as a worthwhile play to maybe dollar cost average for the average guy working for a paycheck or putting in a lump sum and with maybe a positive outlook for the next 2 to 5 years, 10 years.
Yeah, of course. So I think, you know, this goes back to what I said before, where the Ben Graham quote that I stole, which is that in the short term, the market is a voting machine. In the long term, it's a weighing machine. And generally speaking, this isn't even a shot at Tesla. Generally speaking, car businesses, airlines, they're terrible, terrible, terrible businesses. I think there's only three major car companies that have never had to have a bailout. And one of the reasons why Tesla did so well is because there was a massive amount of government stimulus that was going their way. Now, you mentioned FSD. If I recall, I think that was supposed to be done in 2018. The Cybertruck was rushed along to the point where there was a recall within the first couple weeks because there was a gas pedal issue. So from my perspective, I think that Tesla's big benefit is actually in the battery manufacturing part of their business. However, there's been somewhat of a transition away from lithium ion batteries towards sodium batteries. Why? Because they don't need the massive amounts of precious metals and expensive to mine metals that are also, by the way, bad for the environment, the mining practices of getting some of those things out of the earth. And there's this shift, again, to these different types of batteries. So, you know, I also said that past performance isn't indicative of future results. And something we're going to talk a little bit about later is one of the great things that Elon Musk is able to do, which is quantify for you and create for you ideas about products before they even exist. And that's an incredible skill. It's why he's been an incredibly successful CEO. But I think that one of the benefits that Tesla had, and the reason why they were so successful, is because they created a market where the market didn't exist. Nobody was talking about easily, not necessarily easily, but widely produced, not incredibly expensive electric cars. But as soon as that market is created, you're going to have a lot of stiff competition from other places. So I think generally in the next 10 years, Tesla's probably not going to fare as well as it did in the prior five. Does it mean that you shouldn't put some of your money into it? That's your decision. But what I would say is that no name is a name you should go all in on. No name is a name you should go all in on. And so what do I think about Tesla going forward? I'm not as bullish as a lot of people. I think that probably their best days are behind them. And I could be wrong. I could be completely wrong. But just looking at the market as it is now, and I mean the electric vehicle market, looking at the players that are moving in there, looking at the competitive advantages that Tesla had versus what they have now, I certainly don't think it'll be worth $500 in 2 years. Again, could be wrong. I know some people think it's going to be worth $30 trillion. That's patently absurd. But overall, you know, I think you did well with Tesla. I'm not going to diminish that, but going forward, I don't think their prospects look as good for all the reasons that I mentioned as they did the past 5 years. Now let's get back to the InvestTalk voice bank for a question that came in earlier to 888-99-CHART.
This is Alan from Hayward. When I'm researching companies on websites like Morningstar, FinBiz, Yahoo Finance, Mergent Online, they all have different information for many of the company's ratios. For example, the return on assets ratio is different on all four of those websites for the same company. I tested it with multiple companies, and not only were they all off, sometimes the ratios were significantly different. How do I know which website to trust? Clearly, at least three of them are wrong, or maybe all four. I'm using the free version of all four of these websites. Could that be the reason why they're giving me inaccurate information? Thanks again. Love the show.
So the question is, you're getting different results on different websites for essentially the same number. And that's something I've seen as well. Now, of what you mentioned, I would probably trust Morningstar the most. The reason being that Morningstar is a product for institutions that also has a free version, that also has a version that retail uses. Traditionally, people who work within the finance space don't tend to use Yahoo Finance, but it is a problem. It is certainly a problem. The only way to know for sure what is the accurate number might be to dive into annual filings that are available on SEC EDGAR. But, you know, I think that when you err on the side of the tools that are typically used by the industry, like Morningstar is, and of course they use Morningstar Direct in the industry, but still you have access to Morningstar data within the free version. I would err on the side of, again, those websites that also have a version of their product that is traditionally used within the industry.
Every investor is working to build a secure financial future.
Would this be an opportune time to get into annuities?
Everyone's situation is different.
Get your thoughts on CRM, Salesforce.
And so are their questions.
And I was just calling for your assessment of Blackstone Incorporated.
24/7, rain or shine, InvestTalk is made better by the power of you. 888-99-CHART.
Now, I hope you've been telling your friends about the InvestTalk audio podcast and the fact that it is available on YouTube in video form. You can see the charts that Luke and I look at each and every day so that you can get some context to the things that we are saying on air. Now, we get comments in the comment section or questions in the comment section on the YouTube channel as well. So let's answer one of those now. Forrest Becker says, my stock screener has PE, revenue growth, return on assets, return on equity, price of sales, price to book, and beta. I'm able to find some good companies, but also some not so good ones with this screener. Any recommendations to add or delete criteria from my screener? I also tend to look at mid to large cap stocks with low or no dividends. Thank you. Anything you would omit, from that list, Luke, or add?
I think there's some redundancy. You have a couple profitability metrics in there, ROA, ROE. They're probably going to give you the same basket of securities, generally speaking. I think the fact that the commenter is looking at revenue growth is good rather than just looking at revenue. I'd maybe add looking at growth and cash flow from operations, right? If you get more cash flow, that's good for a company. Cash flow is the lifeblood of a company. Maybe take a look at something that's more balance sheet related, like interest coverage ratio, to look at your leverage or debt to equity, something to filter out some of those securities that have too high debt burdens. What about you?
Yeah, I echo all of that for this commenter as well as our listeners. I would once again head over to our YouTube channel, check out yesterday's wealth webinar. We go over a lot of these metrics that we tend to look at and that we think are important and what number to look for. What I would say is, look at these on a sector basis because you're going to have very different ROEs, ROAs, price sales ratios, et cetera, across different sectors. So make sure you're setting the criteria of what you want to see based on more like the industry average versus some raw number. Okay. And then beta, the last one was beta. You know, that's just a measure of volatility to the overall market. That goes back to your risk. Should you want to take more risk or less risk? You said you want more mid caps. Those are going to skew towards higher beta, and you have to be comfortable with that. So thanks for the comments. And yeah, head over to the Wealth webinar from yesterday. Let's go talk to Jason in Illinois. He wants to talk about tax loss selling.
Hi, Justin. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
My question is, do you have to completely sell a stock, or can you sell partial stock to take a tax loss on something you may be down on?
Oh, yeah, you can always take partial. You don't have to sell all of it. Now, if you bought multiple lots, you have to make sure that, you know, your brokerage settings are so that you're actually selling a specific lot that you want. Because there are defaults.
Okay.
It's usually first in, first out, but you can change that, meaning the first lot time you bought it. Right, because you might have bought 100 shares and you bought 25 shares four different times. You have a total of 100 shares. If you sell 25, which lot are you actually selling? So, you know, you might have a gain on one and a loss on another. So you want to make sure that if you're selling partial, that the lot that you're selling is the correct one. And you need to talk to your broker on that.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Now let's go to a call from Tom in Temecula, who has a question on margins.
Okay, I bought NRG at probably at its high, and then it went down a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just, you know, I'm just wondering, how can I lower that cost basis without selling premium? And avoiding the wash sell rule. Do you have any strategies?
Sorry, how can you lower the cost basis of your entry point without sell? Well, there's two ways you can lower your cost basis. You could sell options, right? You already hold the stock, so you're not selling naked options. You could sell options. That premium will go back to what you paid for it, right? That's income into your pocket. The other way is to dollar cost average down in the name. So either you got to buy more shares and that'll lower your overall cost basis, your overall averages, or you have to sell some options if your account is allowed to do so. And that also, in a way, lowers your cost basis because you are getting income for selling those options so long as they don't get called away. And so net, if the stock isn't getting called away, you have paid less for that position as a whole.
This is InvestTalk, made possible by KPP Financial, where each Friday, subscribers to the KPP Premium newsletter receive a concise and highly informative summary of the week's financial and investment news, sent directly to their inbox. It really does give you a week that was roundup in a quick read. It also offers a look ahead and various process and term explanations that will be interesting to every investor. So you should be thinking about subscribing. You'll get targeted value, formatted for fast consumption, when you become a KPP Premium newsletter subscriber at investtalk.com. The InvestTalk Radio and Podcast continues now. The phone lines are open. Call with your questions. 888-99-CHART.
I was wondering if you could explain the difference between ordinary and qualified dividends, and how I can tell which kind the company pays out. Thank you.
I believe those are the same, right? Ordinary. Well, ordinary dividends, they're taxed at your ordinary income tax rate, I believe, right? Yeah, there we go. And qualified are taxed at the lower rates, 15 to 20%. If you're very low income, 0%. But ordinary dividends, yeah, those are going to be taxed at your ordinary income tax rate. Typically, you're looking at two types of companies pay ordinary dividends. And that would be REITs. And technically, REITs aren't a company. That's its own entity structure. And then limited partnerships. Once a company, those tend to come with K-1s, and those also pay ordinary dividends.
I'll also point out passive foreign investment companies and also securities that are registered in countries where we do not have a tax treaty.
Yeah.
Are the other generally two sources.
Yeah. So if they are a corporation, they're domiciled here in the United States, typically you're going to be getting qualified dividends on those names.
Wanted to know about iron butterfly options. I'm pretty experienced in options, but I've never really touched this one. And I was wondering, would it be considered, I guess I would call it a passive aggressive investment, to hunt for flat stocks that are profitable companies and then use iron butterflies to make income over 6 to 9 month periods, or if that just simply wouldn't work? I'd love your feedback on that. Thank you.
Well, it would work if you're picking the right names. And in the option market, there's something called implied volatility. Iron butterflies work when you sell implied volatility on these options at levels that are lower than realized volatility, right? Because the option market is pricing in a certain, it's kind of like a spread on a sports game. In most iron butterflies, you're probably going to make money, but your return's not very high when you do. So for everyone else out there, what they're doing is selling near the money options and buying further out of the money options. So you're getting a net premium because the near the strike price options are worth more than the farther out. You buy the farther out to hedge yourself of major market moves. But ideally, you want the market or that stock to kind of go nowhere and those options to all expire worthless, and you keep the net premium. That's basically what an iron butterfly is. You do it on both calls on each side, both upside and downside. Now, that option market is going to price in some sort of implied volatility. Say it's 30%. And if the realized volatility is less than that, you're generally going to make money. But if it's more than that, you're going to lose money. It's like betting on the favorite in a sporting event. You know, I'm big into basketball. If you go watch an NBA game and it's one of the better teams in the league versus one of the worst teams in the league, the spread's going to be somewhere in the teens, right? 13, 18, 20 points. And you can bet on the favorite and you're probably going to make money because they're probably going to win. Now, are they going to beat the spread? That's another question. That's more complex. It's all about what that spread is, what the implied volatility is. It's not straightforward. If you know a lot of options, you should know options are not straightforward. There's a lot of variables to consider when you're thinking about options overall. So make sure you have a very strong grasp on what the risks and rewards are for iron butterflies if you're going to execute on them. And you can't just blanket make a statement that they're all good or all bad, or it's a good strategy or a bad strategy. It's really about how you execute.
You are listening to an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART. This is an InvestTalk Best of Caller Questions compilation program. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART. That's 888-99-CHART. Justin, Steve, or Luke will answer them on an upcoming podcast.
Hey, Justin and Luke. Bill from Philadelphia here. I just wanted to get an opinion from you guys. Is there ever a time I'd want to go 100% into bonds and treasuries? For example, scenario, 65 years old, collecting Social Security, have, you know, say $2 million in the bank, want to just put that all into bonds and treasuries that pay the yield and pay living expenses, and then maybe a little cash at the end of the month savings to spend on whatever. Just wanted to get your thoughts, if there's ever a scenario for that, or if you guys completely disagree with ever doing that and diversify it more into stocks and bonds and real estate and what have you. Love what you guys do for the show. Thank you.
Yeah, so that's a great question. Should you ever go 100% in treasuries and bonds? And so I think there's some scenarios where that makes sense. One is if you are the most risk-averse person on planet Earth, right? Another is, what's your investment horizon? If you're towards the end of the end stage of life and you have invested enough such that you are pretty much perfectly matching your spending needs, then you really can't take on that risk, right? And so at that point, it becomes a liability matching thing. These are the costs that you're going to incur. This is the money that you have. You know, traditionally speaking, the advice is that early on in your life, you start with a large amount of equity, a little bit of fixed income, and then there's a glide path where those tend to switch as you get older. And I think on the average, that's the correct answer. But there's also people that are in different situations, right? It could be the case that you have enough money saved such that you can pay all of your costs for the rest of your life and leave money for your children 10 times over. Now, that person certainly shouldn't be 100% fixed income. But certainly there could be a situation where you don't have a lot of wiggle room and you can't have any risk tolerance. And so does that situation exist? Yes. Is it probably rarer than you'd think? Probably. But again, everybody's investment needs, everybody's risk tolerance levels differ. So if your circumstances require it, certainly it could be the case that 100% bonds or treasuries make sense for you. Thanks for the call.
This is InvestTalk, made possible by KPP Financial. InvestTalk listeners and KPP clients alike are invited to take advantage of the many products and services of KPP Financial. For example, the InvestTalk radio program and its podcast replays, the new online training experience, InvestTalk Academy, and the KPP premium newsletter,
distributed to subscribers each Friday. Learn more anytime at investtalk.com. The phone lines are open now, and you can call with your questions. 888-99-CHART.
Now, I hope you've been telling your friends and your family members that the InvestTalk audio podcast is now available in video on our YouTube channel. And it seems that every day now we receive finance and investment questions from the comments section of our InvestTalk YouTube channel. And here's one that came in recently. It's on Enerplus Plus and Chord Energy. It says, "Hi, I have a question regarding Enerplus Plus and Chord Energy. These companies are in a sort of merger, it seems, and I wonder if I have to do something as a shareholder. I own shares in Enerplus Plus, the U.S. listed, and today I couldn't buy or sell it. I read somewhere that Enerplus Plus shares you have will convert into Chord Energy shares along with some cash. Is this true? And if it is, while this happens, will this happen automatically, or do I have to do something myself?" So this is a good opportunity to give a little refresher on merger activity. So when a company proposes to buy another company for shares or for cash, or in this case, a little bit of both, typically the only thing a shareholder has to do if they wish to have shares of the new company or get the cash is either A, nothing, or B, vote when the proposition comes to the shareholder vote. And so we talked about how oftentimes when you hold something in a fund, you don't vote. The fund manager votes. And if you're the beneficial owner, you do have the right to vote. Now, in this specific case, the board and the shareholders approved this. So after that being said, no, there is nothing for you to do. The Enerplus Plus shares will delist. It will become Chord Energy. You will receive your shares and your cash all automatically. There's nothing you got to do yourself. Thanks for watching. And keep in mind that if you are interested in getting your question answered promptly, feel free to go over to our InvestTalk YouTube channel. It's InvestTalk with two T's, and leave a comment for us.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm, which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Steve Peasley is president, and Justin Klein is chief executive officer of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.